Hey, this is Chavo Guerrero Jr. from Lucha Underground, and you're listening to the Handsome TV Express.
Well, hello, dear reader, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 36 of the Handsome TV Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things. You can find on iTunes, or you can just Google Dan and Travis, and it will certainly come up. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. I want to thank everybody for downloading, retweeting, Pinteresting, just spreading the word, and the traffic was great for last week's episode with Daphne Ashbrook. They are still raising funds for the Indiegogo, so please go ahead if you haven't heard it. Go ahead and download, check out the interview, or retweet it. Keep spreading the word. If you want great indie movies, sometimes we got to fund them ourselves. Speaking of movies, you know, I've wanted to have this gentleman on the show for a while because far too often we think of the industry as either New York, LA, maybe London, and a couple of other cities. But the entertainment industry and the entertainment film community, and even some big studio film work and TV work, is happening in a lot of cities across the country, and one of which. One city that it's really exploded in, and it's my adopted home away from home, is the city of Boston. And my guest today is a fellow who finds himself kind of constantly in the center of the entertainment industry in Boston. Anytime I meet somebody who's like, oh, I've done work in Boston, do you know this guy? Oh, of course I know him. And so I had to get him on the show to talk about the world of the industry in Boston. Welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Chuck Slavin.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Doing good, Chuck. How are you? And you are in the midst of a pretty busy day yourself already. You're calling me in the middle of all the action.
That's right. But I have time for the handsome man. I am very fortunate that even being on the East Coast, I know how handsome you are. So.
Oh. And, well, hey, who, I'm not. I didn't have you on the show to argue with you. So, thanks for the kind words. How did you get started in the entertainment business, and how did you find yourself just in the thick of things in Boston?
Well, you know, I did a lot of theater and public access and stuff like that when I was a kid, and so eventually what happened was I made a friend who also did some theater with me, and we were always talking about, like, you know, being involved in movies and that sort of thing. So he decided that he was going to move out to LA, so I was like, I'm coming with you. I don't care. So I dropped everything and I took a road trip out to LA and I wanted to just experience it all. And who knew, you know, maybe just get my big break. So, I went out to LA and I tried it for a little while. I was very fortunate. I landed a couple of small gigs. One of my first things I did was 6 Feet Under. I was a featured extra in that. Nice. And then I did like a Moby video and, I did one other, I think I was kicked off the Daredevil set because I wasn't on the list, but that's beside the point.
That's probably no bad thing, that Daredevil. We're talking about the old Daredevil, not the new Netflix one.
Correct. Yeah. So I tried it out there for a little while, and then I found myself I didn't have the funds to match the expectations. So I ended up coming back to Boston and saying, you know, I'm going to try it again at some point.
But as you came back, a lot of things were happening in Boston, it sounds like. Or it seemed
right.
The timing was right.
I felt myself in that situation where you're like, is this the right time at the right place? Because when I came back, I had taken all my headshots and all this, you know, all the knowledge and everything that I learned out there, and I just like stuck it under the bed, and it was like collecting dust. And then two big movies came in, Departed and Mystic River. And when the first one, Mystic River, came in, I had this really terrible car. And I went to the casting call, and I, you know, there was a line on the form that you fill out that was like, what kind of a car do you have? And I was like, oh, my God, I don't even want to tell them. You know, I don't even want them to know that I have this Camaro from, like, 1987 with the door busted, you know? But it turned out that's exactly what they wanted. They wanted a car to be on the side of this road that was, like, you know, a dirtbag street that had this busted up Camaro. So, you know, I got the call and I show up on set and it's like, you know, Clint Eastwood and, you know, Sean Penn and, you know, Tim Robbins and everybody. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm here. Like, this is incredible. But I was there because it was my car, you know? So it was kind of one of those, like, the blessing and the curse. And so, you know, so I worked a couple days on set. I felt very fortunate. And then, you know, it all went away. It was, you know, that was the movie and that was it. And then So then the Departed came in, and the same deal. I had a Mustang this time. It was a very, crappy Mustang. It was just a friend was getting rid of his car and was like, here, take the car. So, so I took the car, and then again, they were like, I love the car. Like, bring it on down to set. So I went to set, and I got to, be on set for the night, and it was an overnight. And then at about midnight, they wrapped a bunch of people, but they kept like four or five of the people that had cars. And so I was just sitting there listening to, a couple of the other extras talk. And then I'm like, all right, I guess I'll talk to them. I don't know. I'm a people person. I like to make small talk, but I'm also like, I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing and paying attention, So I started talking to this woman who is a casting director out here. Her name is Jody Purdy Quinlan. And she sort of was like, what you've got to do is find the industry here. There's an industry here. Yeah. And I'm like, there's an industry here? I didn't even know it. I had no idea. So, so I started talking to her, and then I started realizing that, there was stuff going on here. Because originally, when I left L.A., I was like, I'm going to save my money, and I'm either going to go back to L.A. or I'm going to go to New York, because it's the only way to really make it, So then I started – so as this was going on, though, behind the scenes, the legislature was talking about a film tax credit.
Right.
And so that was the big piece to the puzzle that, I had no idea about it. I had no idea what was going on. But as the talking came about, then all of a sudden we had the film tax credit. And it was like, it was just a big boom to the economy out here, as far as all of a sudden there's five or six movies in a row. And now, being on the ground floor, I was like, this is it, and now there's going to be films, and there's going to be a chance for me to work. So I was very excited.
Yeah, because it's pretty cool, because it sounds like you were going through what so many people go through in the business, which is that so close but so far feeling. But you seem to be able to hang on through all that and make it pay off.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm somebody that, I don't take no very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm dedicated and I'm focused. So, even in that situation where it's like, I knew the chips and the cards were stacked against me, but it's like, if I just keep coming out and trying, or at least trying to dig around as much as I can, then I don't want it ever to be, I didn't look for it.
Right.
I don't want to ever have that feeling of like, could I have done more? I want to make sure that, when I do things, it's like always doing as much as possible, so that it's never like, I was almost there, but I didn't keep going.
No, because that's it's so funny, because the fear that, failing is a really hurtful, painful thing, but the not even trying, that's a real empty, just, oh gosh, that's regret and all kinds of things, How was the transition for you from in front of the camera to behind the camera? Was that a hard transition, or was that something you took to?
Well, so along the lines of the credit, we had our governor, our former governor, mentioned capping the credit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that happened, it was like I just became broke. Like, it was like trying to figure out, okay, now, because I was focused so much on acting, I didn't have the mindset of like, maybe I should do behind the scenes. So
right.
A friend of mine who's a first AD was like, look, and he called me Charlie, which I don't like that name, but that's okay. If he wants to call me Charlie, he's a first AD. He can do it.
It's true.
He said, Charlie, look, if you want to stay in the business, if you want to keep going, then you're going to have to get behind the scenes, because, you are an asset to have in production, because people's names. And that is such a crucial thing. Most people don't realize that. But
mm-hmm.
If you know people and you're a people person, you're going to do well, because, a lot of it is you're 16, you're 15, you're 14 hours with people. And if they know who you are, there's certain questions they never have to ask, and so you can just move along with your day. And so I pondered it for a little bit, and I'm like, oh, no. And then I started realizing that, that's a smart road to take. So I started getting involved in doing some production stuff. And then I just started getting very fortunate in that, where, people started calling me up and saying, hey, do you want to work on this? And then you kind of build like a group of friends that just start calling you. And then, that's how it works, So it got good. And then I started climbing up and learning different jobs, And that, I think, is a very good skill to have, is the more jobs on set, the more jobs you can have,
No,
and that's
absolutely
something that I think has fared me well.
No, absolutely. So when you got behind the scenes, I mean, did you have specific goals in mind of things that you wanted to do? Or were you just like, I just want to be on set. I want to be involved, whatever I could do.
Look, I say all the time, from the broom to the boom, I don't care what job it is, as long as I'm there and, like, I'm involved in what's going on, I know that at some point, you know, if it's meant to happen, it's going to happen. But if I'm not there, if I'm not on set, it's not going to happen. I mean, you have to get yourself there. And it's like, you know, there is obviously for everybody, you know, there's some days you're going to be doing a really good job, and then there's other days you're going to be doing something else. And if you don't want to accept that, then, you know, it's just part of the rodeo. You've got to know, like, what it is that it takes to make this thing go. And so, you know, for me, it's just always been like, I've always just been really excited about the business. I'm passionate about the business.
Yeah.
You know, I knew coming in from the beginning, being in Boston, being outside of New York and L.A., that the chips were stacked against me. So, you know, it's always felt like a blessing to just be on set, you know, and that's been one of those things that I've never forgotten my being fortunate for that.
Yeah, it's funny because I know several PAs who have said to me, and it's not, I'm not knocking these folks for saying it, but sometimes they'll say, like, you know, being a PA, it's like beneath me. And I'm like, look, it's beneath everybody who's a PA. You know, that's everybody who's been a PA. This is, you know, very much menial work that is not super challenging intellectually and creatively, but it's super important at the same time. And everybody knows it's beneath you, but if you can make it work and just do it and have fun with it and everybody's going to be so impressed with that, much more so than because everybody knows it's beneath you, you know?
Well, and that's kind of, you know, and my take on it is I used to box. And obviously being from Boston, one of our champions is Rocky Marciano. And, you know, so Rocky Marciano was a guy who all he did was study the basics. Yeah. So I kind of come into to the production world with like study the basics. So it's like if you can do PA work, that's the basics. So the better you are as a PA, the more prepared you are for anything. You know, there's certain things you wouldn't even know that could prepare you. Like, you know, like things that you kind of learn even waiting tables, like carry a lighter. It's like so many people smoke in this industry. You got a lighter on you, now you can light somebody's cigarette, you know? I mean, it's silly things like that, that like as you get more and more, like you've learned that like there's simple things, like if somebody gives you an order, you write it down, you know, or you know, just simple stuff like that. I think that a lot of people overlook that.
Yeah.
And that sometimes is the stuff that like can just make you that much better in the industry. And that can certainly make people look at you and say, wow, this guy actually cares. Because if, you know, and another side of it is you're working on a $5 million, a $10 million movie. And if somebody's like, look, I want my coffee with cream and sugar. Yes, that is beneath all of us. But at the same time, if you bring back that coffee with cream and sugar, you are the day's hero.
Yep.
Because you remember exactly what that person wanted.
That's right.
And so if they trust you with their sugar and they trust you with their cream, then eventually they're going to trust you with, you know, their cash. And that's where you want to get to. You want to get to them saying, look, I'm making a $10 million movie. This guy gets me really good coffee. I'm bringing him with me.
Well, the more you succeed at stuff, the more they'll give you to do. You know,
yes.
The more they're going to throw you
yes.
the ball. We bring up two positions here, Chuck, and I'd love to get your take on this, which is a PA, production assistant, and AD, which
yep.
is assistant director. And I think a lot of people don't know, this might be a good opportunity to talk about this.
Yep.
When shit all goes wrong on set, when everything falls apart, when the schedule goes to hell, the two positions that are relied upon the most are AD and production assistants. Those are the people that are going to end up fixing it.
Oh yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. When you're an AD or you're a production assistant, you're in essence you're a part of the army.
I mean,
if there's a problem, you are the ones that are gonna. You are the ground troops. You are the
yeah.
ones that it's like everything revolves around your preparation. So, and that's the thing. What a lot of people don't understand is that an AD can be amazing, but if they don't have the support, then it's like it all starts to fall apart because you need to be, when you're in that AD position, you need to be like the head of the octopus, you know? You need to have those tentacles in everything so that there's never a problem, so you're always ahead of stuff because if something falls, then chances are it becomes that house of cards where everything starts falling down because, you know, there was one key piece of the puzzle that wasn't in place
yeah.
that somebody dropped the ball on. But if you have a well-oiled machine, then even if that one thing that you weren't thinking of, whether it be, you know, who knows, preparing some car that you needed on set or, you know, or something in the schedule that was overlooked. If you have a really good team and you have a really good, you know, situation where you can, like, overcome, then that those are times when they really make really good ADs. They really make really good PAs. And just much like the Army, I mean, you know, you can rise up the ranks pretty quickly if you're really on top of your game. And just like you said, if you come in and you succeed, you're going to keep going, you know, and that's it.
It's so funny. I've interviewed a few directors on the show, Chuck, and they echo a lot of what you're talking about. And that's a key word there is preparation. I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about, it might sound like a stupid question, but like, especially in the world of production where like so many unexpected things happen and so many unpredictable things happen, what is your advice for being prepared? Like, cause you can't prepare for everything. But
no, and that,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, that's it. Like, how do you prepare for the unexpected?
Well, and that's a lot of times, you know, I think that's the situation in life, and that's a situation in production. That's a situation all the time. It's just like, you know, it's like police. It's like firemen. You cannot prepare for anything. You can't. You can be as prepared as possible, but stuff is going to happen. So what you have to do is it's almost like a life change where you've prepared your whole life for like moments, you know? And so it's like it's the same as why I think a lot of times people get stuck in those cycles, because what happens is you just have stuff in your life that isn't situated. So then it's like that starts to bother you, and then that affects something else, which affects something else. So when you come in and you're working production, you have to literally think about your day and like, how do I get myself ahead of the game? So when those things happen, when those like problems arise, how do I just keep moving? How do I move on past the problem? Because we all know the problem is coming. The problem is going to come, but it's about how do I stay and maintain so that when the problem comes, it doesn't throw like the whole cart, you know, it's like a bump in the road. You just have to keep moving and make sure that, you know, preparation is part of why, like, I go back to learning the basics, like the Rocky Marciano motto, which is that if you're really good at the basic stuff, then when the problem arises, you're going to do your best to CYA, you know, because you've got to make sure that if you cover yourself, then you're going to cover your boss and you're going to cover everybody above you, because it's like, look, we had the proper preparation. We were ready to go. And this problem still arose. But you know what? We're going to move on and we're going to go past it. And I think that if you come in with a motto that I learned actually waiting tables, which is you set yourself up for success. Nobody sets you up for success. You have to set yourself up for success. You have to know, look, something is going to go wrong. There's going to be busy times. How do I prepare myself for when that happens? And that's kind of the mindset you have to take, because if you don't take that mindset, you know, and you're just like, oh, cool, I'm on the movie set, and now I can chill out and wear my shades and drink iced coffee. Like, you know, no, you can't. Like, you're here, but remember, there's tons of people that want to be here. So, you know, always be ready for it, you know?
Damn, Chuck, you're talking about a lot of really good themes that I love talking about with people in the sense of not even just gratitude, but, like, the gratitude of knowing, you know, you are lucky to be on set. There's probably, like, 10,000 or 50,000 people that would kill to have been on The Departed or Mystic River or some of the big shows you've been on in Boston. Of course, you know what I mean? That's a big deal, like walking up and being on set with Clint Eastwood and stuff. Yeah, working in the business is a privilege. I think you're absolutely right to say that, and I think that's a really great reminder. But I want to touch upon something else you talked about before, and I know that you're kind of a networking ace from everything I've heard, because I've heard it from other people in our network, which says it all. But one of the things that I think is a really good thing to do that you talked about, and again, your back-to-basics thing, which is you mentioned, so I was on set, and then I started talking to people. And I think far too often we get really shy or we get scared or we're like, oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to talk to that person or that first AD or whatever. Yes, no, go ahead and talk to them. If they're too busy to talk to you, they'll let you know and they'll say, bug me at lunch or something like that. But yeah, I think that's a really great and simple piece of advice.
Well, and I think that's the key as well, is to knowing when are good times. I remember I worked for a casting director for a while, and the only times I talked to that casting director were like twice a day. That was it. And I mean, I worked for like a month straight. And it was literally at the end of the night, it was to close the blinds. And then in the morning, it was like to turn on the lights. And that was the only time I ever talked to them. And at the end of the whole thing, it was like I was the best friend for life, because I knew that, like, you know, sometimes not talking is more important than talking. It's like, there are times when it's like, if you can just let that person breathe, then they are going to make sure that they know that, look, I'm here, and if you need me, you call me. But if you don't need me or don't want to talk, then I'm not going to talk to you.
Right.
Because I'm going to wait until you're ready. Because you know what? It's not that important to me. It's like, because I know when you need me, you're going to call on me. You're going to ask me to do something, you know? And I think that that's a lot of it, too, because, you know, trust me, I'm a networker for life. Like, I love networking because I love people. But at the same time, I know that, especially in this business, a lot of times people don't get that break. And so it becomes like, that's when they become that time where it's like, if you wait, it'll be the right time. It'll be the right time to engage and talk. And then once you can feel that, then it's a bigger bond than just like, hey, I'm forcing myself to talk to you, or you're forcing yourself to talk to me, you know?
So picking
that's
the,
a lot.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
What's that?
No, I was going to say, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's kind of just the way that I come at it, because, you know, I just feel like, you know, I know that people want some time to breathe themselves.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's a great reminder to know when, you know what I mean? Know how to read a room and how to read people. Let's just dive into the network thing here for a bit, because you are extremely, you're not shy at all. And I know that that certainly helps, and you're a people person. But what are your sort of like networking tips and like networking sort of style, if that's the right word to use?
Well, you know, I think for me personally, it's like sometimes, you know, when you're a good networker, you know, and this is like anything in life, you get branded in either the good terms or the bad terms. I, fortunately, a lot of times I get the good terms, because I think people realize, you know, what it is that I'm doing and how, like, you know, I like people and I'm a people person. Sometimes you do get the people that are like, this guy's a shameless self-promoter. A lot of times, you know, it's that thing where, you know, you get kind of branded like a shameless self-promoter, or somebody that's, you know, just trying to do this for yourselves. And I think that what I try to do is just make sure that people know, like, when I'm talking to them or whatever, that, like, you know, it isn't that way. Like, I want to talk to people. I enjoy people, you know? And so, you know, but part of it is too, like, if you meet somebody and you're trying to network with them, you want to make sure you get that number, get that phone number, or get that name, because, you know, a lot of times, especially in this business, you're meeting people so quickly sometimes, but if you don't get that name or number right away, it's going to slip by, you know? So you got to make sure that, you know, and be ready. Have your business card. Be ready. Be ready to at least pass it on. And don't, you know, you can't, again, you got to make sure that when people are wanting to talk to you, that's when you talk to them, you know?
Now, Chuck, for a guy like you, I mean, you're a pretty outgoing and friendly and personable guy. But not everybody is necessarily as outgoing, and some folks get shy or insecure. And I know that sometimes, even if they're not shy and insecure, people can sometimes feel like, oh gosh, I don't want it to come off like I'm asking people for things, like I'm asking this person for this kind of opportunity or this, that, and the other thing. What would be your advice for folks like that who sometimes have a hard time reaching out to people?
Well, you know, the first thing I would say, what's very important in networking is reading other people. You know, you want to make sure that when somebody wants to talk, that's when you talk to them, you know, because especially in this business, like, everybody has so many things that they have to do and their mind is in so many places. And so what you try to do is you try to find a time when that person wants to talk to you, because what is important is that, you know, a lot of times too, like, you'll be talking to somebody maybe on set who might be production or involved in something else, and they're on a radio. So, you know, they wear an earpiece. You don't know when they're talking to somebody else,
exactly,
or when somebody else is talking to them.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of chatter. So you have to make sure that if you're talking to somebody, they're ready to talk to you. Because what you don't want to do is start talking to somebody and they're pulled away from the conversation, or you're talking to somebody and you're distracting them from doing their job. Because a lot of times too, like, when you're on set, perception is reality. If you're over there chit-chatting, or if you're talking to somebody, you know, a lot of times people won't know, you know, what's going on. And they'll be like, oh, that guy's bothering him. He's trying to do his work, you know. And so you got to be just smart about it. You know, obviously when you're at parties and stuff like that, you want to network away. Network with everyone, you know. And don't forget, like sometimes if you're at a party, sometimes even the waiters and the waitresses might be in the business, you know. So you got to make sure that, like, don't ever underestimate anybody that's in the room, you know. And I think that's a big key, you know, because I remember when I first came back from LA and I was trying to get involved in networking. You know, one of the first things somebody said to me was, I was at this party and the guy was like, oh, so you're an actor. And I was like, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I don't need to talk to you.
Yeah.
I remember that burn.
It's the worst.
I just remember that burn.
The worst.
Yeah. Like, it was the worst feeling ever. And then I remember, like, 2 years later, I saw the guy and he's like, oh, you're out doing great stuff, you know. Will you help me out? Will you help me do this thing? And I'm like, I just remember in my mind going like, are you serious? And then I was like, you know what? But I'm going to be the bigger person. I will help you. But then after it was all said and done and I helped him out, I remember just being like, hey, man, just remember, when I first met you, you told me I was just an actor. And those are two words, like, for me, that absolutely they're the biggest pet peeves for me, which is just and only. Because in this business, you're not only anything, and you're not just anything. Because, you know, a lot of times, like, if you want to really propel in this industry, you can't just be anything, and you can't only be something. You've always got to be changing and always adapting and always trying to build the skills and, you know, and keep moving forward. So I think that's a big key to networking, too, is, like, anybody you're talking to is the most important person in the room, you know? And I think you have to always portray that because, you know, sometimes you get one conversation with a person and then you don't see them for 2-3 years and then you come back and it's like, hey man, what's going on? And like, if you were somebody that they didn't have a connection with or they didn't like enjoy talking to, then when they see you in 2 years, they may be on top of the world and they're now like, who are you again? I don't know you. And just not even willing to engage. So, you know, it's important just to remember that, you know, at the end of the day, we're all humans. And we're all looking to be loved, of course, and to be, you know, and to be important. So every conversation is important. And every conversation is, you know, it's something that may not make sense now, but, you know, later on, that's a conversation with somebody who might be able to help you in some time that you have no idea is going to happen.
I think that's an absolutely fantastic point. And it's funny, we're talking about the unpredictability of production, but there's also sort of like an unpredictability to your career. Like, and as I've talked to a lot of folks on this podcast and people at various positions, and they get into the business for over 5-10 years, they'll tell you, you can't predict where your career is going. And I think some people make that mistake. I think that fellow you're talking about in your story probably made that mistake of like, well, I need to meet X, Y, and Z. And if I don't meet them, then my career is not going to take the right trajectory. And it's like, that's not how it works. Like, I went through a sort of similar deal in Austin at the film festival where a few people would walk up to me. I was wearing a suit. And they would sort of see, and they would notice my badge, and they'd see I was a writer, and you could see their face fall, because I was in a suit, and they thought I was like a lawyer, a producer, or a manager, an agent. You know what I mean? And when they found out I was a writer, they were like, ugh. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. And it's not like if you're looking for that magical agent or magical producer, if you're like, oh, I can't waste time talking to an actor because I have to meet somebody over there who's going to open the keys to the kingdom for me. That's not how it works. Like, you're not going to meet that person.
No,
that person doesn't exist.
And, you know, and that right there is the point that I live by, which is that no one is going to give me the keys to the kingdom. I already have the keys to the kingdom. I just have to realize where my kingdom is. And that,
that's
what it is. I mean,
that's great.
You have to live in your own kingdom. And that's the fact of the matter. So if you want to live in a kingdom where you're willing to shut everybody out and tell people to go away, then you're going to be in a lonely tower, I'll tell you right now, because that's not the kingdom I know I want to live in. I want to live in a kingdom with a bunch of jesters and, you know, cool stuff happening every day.
No, absolutely, and you can't. You cannot be, I'm sorry, I can't think of a single example off the top of my head of somebody I've met who's like a lone wolf or a lone shark. Even Stanley Kubrick often said in interviews about how many people he surrounded himself with on set to help him make his decisions. You just can't be that lone wolf. You have to surround yourself with smart, intelligent, talented people. Now, well, this thing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna add to that point.
Please.
And that's it. I mean, you can't be scared to add smart people around you.
Yeah.
You have to trust in your team. I mean, that that's, you know, it's such a valid point, but it's also something that a lot of people forget is like, oh, I'm going to put these people around me because they're going to tell me yes, or they're not going to question what I'm saying. And that's a silly way to go about it. I mean, you know, if you want to run in a wolf pack, you got to make sure every one of your wolves is ready to find you food. Like, you don't want to run with a bunch of wolves that are skinny and aren't eating. I don't want to run with that.
No,
you know, I want to run with the smartest animals in the kingdom.
Okay, now you're a guy, I know, you know, just to fill some folks in here, Chuck and I worked together on the first season of Boston's Finest for TNT, and I saw Chuck in action firsthand with you and your team, and a lot of guys like Scotty would tell me, like, oh, Chuck's like my agent, you know, Chuck finds this and that, like, he's the guy that does all this stuff. And so you have a reputation for helping people out. How much has that, and this might sound like kind of a ruthless question, but I don't mean it like that. I mean it to talk about the mutual advantageous nature of networking, which is how many times have you helped people out and that has in turn turned around and helped you out? And those people have turned around and helped you sometimes get out of sticky situations or what have you.
Well, I'll give you a prime example, and I'll tell you, you know, I have to give tons of shout outs to people that I would, you know, quote unquote my team, which of course, you know, on that show, Chip and Scotty, like, they were instrumental in being there for me to have my back and, like, being guys, you know, and then we brought in this kid, Jimmy Friday, you know. So, like, just people that are willing and want to learn, but also willing to step up and do what's required and find themselves being able to set themselves up for success, you know. And so I worked at a small independent film, and I remember, you know, the producer was like, oh, well, we've got a couple of these guys that are coming on and we're not paying them much. And, you know, and but they're young kids and they want to learn. And I remember my first instinct was like, you know, was this instinct of like, oh, great. So you want me to teach these people so that then in the next movie they could take my job? Is that what you're trying to say to me or what? Like, you know, because you get that, you first get that jaded Hollywood feel, you know?
Sure.
But I was like, you know what? I was like, you know what? I don't care. You know, I got a job right now, and if they don't look good, I don't look good. And you know what?
That's right.
If they want to replace me, I don't care because I know how good I am. So it's like, if you want the best, you're going to hire the best. And so I took a bunch of these guys, and I was like, look, here's the deal. I'm going to teach you guys a bunch of stuff, and if you don't know anything, if you don't know what's going on, you come to me and say, I got a question. And if you have a question, we're going to use like a code word. You tell me to pause or something like that, and I will then tell you how to do it. Because I know how hectic it gets on set. I know how crazy it is. And a lot of times, you get so scared to take a moment and ask somebody something that it's like, you're in like, I don't know what to do, but now I'm going to mess up because I'm in the frantic mode. So,
exactly.
You know, so I just said, look, here's my deal. I'll train these guys. They'll help me out. But I need a couple days with them before we get on set. Because I know what's going to happen. You're going to tell me, because I remember this from, like, waiting tables, which is the biggest joke of waiting tables is training. They're always like, you're going to get 5 days training. You're going to get 7 days training. And then you're going to go in and you're going to start taking tables. Very slowly, you're going to take tables. Then every time, I remember, you would start on, like, a Monday. And then on Friday, they'd be like, oh, yeah, by the way, you have a section on Friday night. You're in there all by yourself.
You
know?
Right.
And that's kind of, like, what I've geared to, like, to like filmmakers, the same kind of thing. Training is the biggest joke. It's like, yeah, you're going to get training. No. You're going to get thrown out there and you're going to sink or swim. So, you know, so what's really important though is to find people that want to learn. If you think you already know everything, then there's no point. I mean, go out there, try to swim. I don't know what to tell you. You said you knew everything. But if you're willing to learn, if you're willing to just ask and say, hey, look, I want to learn. I want to know what's going on. Then it makes it so much easier because it's like, look, I'm not going to try to screw you. Trust me. I know how some guys do it. They throw everybody under the bus, and then they stand there and they say, I'm the only one who can do the job.
Yeah.
Well, to me, that looks silly because if you want to be good and you want to look great, then you surround yourself with the Avengers, and you're like a team of people that are really good. And that's why I was so fortunate on, you know, on Boston's Finest, because I had a bunch of guys, and I felt like we were like the X-Men. We came in, we were like, everybody was ready to go. Nobody ever had any questions. Like, we just knew what each other was doing and what each other was thinking. And we became a unit. And that's what you strive for. But in these situations, like that show that I worked on, you know, I was able to take a bunch of guys and train them so that they were good. And we finished the show. Nobody messed anything up. Nobody was fired. And at the end of the day, we got from A to B. That's what you need. You just need to get from A to B. So you know, and those are all guys that I would hire again, and those are all people that I know vice versa, because you never know again where your career is going to go in this business. I know they would hire me, and I would hire them, and that's, you know, and that's, again, why you would want to run in a good pack, so you can keep eating.
No, honestly, that's so true. And one of my, I mean, I don't know how much we can talk about, because there's NDAs and non-disclosure agreements and stuff, but I think I can say, well, first of all, Boss's Finest had a great crew from top to bottom. I mean, the producers were good. I mean, such a good crew. And but I remember we would have to make these story presentations for whoever it was, the executives or Robin or, you know, the network, what have you. Robin Uni, the executive producer. And, like, it was, like, you and Scotty and Chip sometimes would come in and help me out. Because it was just like, okay, well, we got to do this three-day presentation in one day. And you guys would just help me. And it was just, it was fun. Like my memories of those days were, like, we got a lot of good, hard work done. Everything was clear. We had to go over stuff. And, yeah, the guys did want to learn, because we had a lot of, like, hey, what's this like? What's that like? What's this thing in L.A. like? And then we just, what's Boston been like? And just, we were able to bullshit and get it all done. But it was hard working, but it was fun working, if that makes sense. And I like what you said as far as, what's one of my favorite phrases from the world of wrestling. When everybody looks good, everybody looks good. It's the best thing in the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's why I think it was so easy on a show like that, was having so many people that knew how important it was, you know? I mean, we were like mini cops. I mean, we were JV almost, you know? We had to ride with them and be ready for anything. And no one knew, no one could predict what would happen, so we had to be ready for that. And I think that was the biggest thing, is being ready and getting into that position where we could then chill out, you know? And that's that thing where it's like, we want to learn everything we can, and when there's downtime, well, then we're going to chill out. But when we're ready to go, oh, we are ready to go.
Yeah.
Like, there's no questions asked. We're ready to go, you know? And that's why, again, like, you know, I mean, obviously I can't say everything, but guys like Chip have gotten really good jobs where they're now, like, assisting world-famous actors, and they know their value, and they see that, like, you know, we're here to work, but we're also here because we want to be here. And I think that that's the part that matches, you know, the other side of it that a lot of people don't see. You got to want to be here.
Damn
right.
And
then you got to be able to do the job, you
Damn
know?
Right. That goes so far. That's the thing, like, I remember about you and Scotty and stuff, and Chip, was it was always smiles. Everybody's always smiling. It was always a laugh, and it was always no matter, even, and now we worked hard. I mean, Boss's Finest had a tough schedule just based upon the nature of what we were shooting. But it was always a laugh. And I think that's really, really important, because if people are moping around and complaining all the time, forget about it. That just makes it 1,000 times worse.
Well, and that's the other side that a lot of people don't realize about reality. I mean, again, you know, there's a difference between reality and there's a difference between features, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In features, you're taking what somebody would do in 1 week of their life and portraying it like it's 7 years. In a reality show, you're taking somebody's 7 years and trying to cram it into one day.
Yeah, that's true.
So a big important part of that was, you know, people got to like us, because if they don't like us and you're not genuinely a good person and you're not generally a people person, then it doesn't matter how good you are, because we're dependent on this other person to allow us to be in their life. We're dependent on this other person to say, hey, come with me. I want to show you some cool stuff. I want you to come and meet my family, you know? And that was what was so awesome about Boston Finest, as we've already stated. But I think that what one of the biggest parts was, we had such an awesome crew on that show.
Yeah.
You know, the cameraman, like, everybody was awesome. And so I think it was very easy, because we had, you know, a good line producer. We had a great story producer. I mean, we had our top dogs that were so excited to be there and knew that, look, at any moment these guys could say no. So it was very important that, you know, we have to have some reciprocity in, they got to like us and we got to like them. And so, you know, and that's kind of the same thing. You got to walk into every situation in the entertainment industry and realize, look, if they don't like you, that could be the end of that part of the choose your own adventure, you know, and you're going to have to flip,
right.
You're going to have to flip back and start again, you know, because if somebody doesn't like you, that sometimes that's it, you know, they don't like the color of your shoes. It can be as simple as that. And then you got to start climbing the ladder all the way from the bottom again, you know?
No, that's absolutely
And I think
right.
It takes a long time to realize that, you know?
Well, I think there's also a sense in some people. I've seen a sense in some folks, not a lot, not everybody. I don't want to generalize too much, but whenever a sense of entitlement pops up in somebody on a crew, I'm like, uh-oh, that's going to be trouble. That's going to be trouble because, you know, I mean, I've been a pretty high-ranking producer who's been the guy that's had to, you know, sweep the driveway because nobody else is doing it. You know, or yeah. Like, oh, it's up to us. We got to do the lunch run because all the PAs are out there getting the set ready. So guess what? Well, it's up to me. I'm going to have to go do it. And if you got that guy on set who's like, well, I don't do that. I'm not doing that. You know, that person, I shouldn't, you know, is not going to be very popular very long, and then people aren't going to want to work with him very much or her.
Well, and, you know, and I think it's, you know, in the same sense, even though this is a crazy analogy, but in the same sense, it's like a casino. You know, there's mm-hmm. a difference in the business with the people that have come to the casino and the people that are going to stay at the casino, you know? Mm. And it's about weathering in these situations where it's like, oh yeah, all the PAs are out and you're going to be the guy that's going to pick up the garbage. You know, it's a sense of like, well, I know I'm going to stay here and I'm going to be doing this long enough that when the PAs get back, I'm going to have something really bad for them to do. So I'll do the trash now, but wait till I get them later, you know? So it's that sense of like, look, you are going to do stuff that you may not want to do, but you're going to be here a long time if you do that stuff. And so, you know, exactly. You got to suck it up sometimes and you got to power through, because the big picture is, you know, it, it's one of those things where as long as you're in the business, there are going to be times when you're going to feel like, oh my God, why am I getting water for this person who is so below me? But it's like, you know, but I know how important it is that this person drinks some water, you know? So you got to kind of realize where you are in the spectrum and just figure out that, like, you know, there are going to be times when even the lead actors, they come in on set one day and they're almost background because they're in the scene, but they don't have any lines. They're not saying anything, but it's like, they're so intricate to the whole big picture that they got to realize, look, like, yeah, it may feel like that today. I mean, obviously they're getting the pay, but, you know, at the same time, it might not be something as important as they think they should be doing.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, I also think too that, like, whenever I see the, you know, it's, and I am glad to say it's not often that I see somebody that pulls that kind of attitude. Like, I can see them pretty clearly. Like, it's not a ton of them, but it's like one of those things of, like, you know, it's remembered and in a way that's like, you know, you put some short term quote unquote humiliation or something that's beneath you ahead of a very long term reward. Because if you are that guy that turns around and is like, I don't care, I'll take out the trash, I'll sweep the driveway, I'll do whatever, I don't care. If you are that guy, you're a friggin' hero. Guy,
oh, yeah.
You're going to be a hero. And then you reach that point where it's like you're working so hard and you're doing so much stuff, you're so positive, people will never even think of you as a PA. They just think of you as a hero on set. They'll just be like, oh, that guy's a hero. They get it. He or she, they get it done. And
yeah,
that the rewards for that are much more fulfilling. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say, and that kind of comes on that story about failing up in Hollywood. It's not always true. I mean, you when you succeed, you go up. You know, it's not just about failing. That just might be the instant reaction to think like, oh, they're promoting this guy.
Right.
You know?
Right. No,
but it's like
true.
No. If you're doing your job, you don't realize where you are. You know. So.
Yeah,
it's important to remember that.
There's a lot of super successful directors and producers and executives who absolutely took the trash out. And I know it because I know them. I know their stories. And they'll tell it. And that's the other thing too. It becomes a badge of honor because they're the ones that are like, well, I did that. I did that. I'm not, isn't it, you know what I mean? You can be that person. Like you were describing before, knowing how to do everything on a set and trying to know as many of those things on a set. That's actually like, that's an expertise, you know, and that's something to be worn proudly.
Yeah, well, and that's that kind of that band of brothers thing too. Like, you know, who do you want leading the troop? You know, do you want the guy that never went to war, or you want the guy that's battle tested?
You want the guy who's dug the trenches. Yeah,
exactly. You want the guy that's going to know the shortcuts. That's like, look, you're going out into the woods to battle. I'll tell you this: bring a bottle, bring this, bring that. You know, you want that guy that knows what to actually bring, the practical stuff, not the guy that's like, well, when you go out there, you're going to make yourself a tree. You're going to make yourself a fort. And then you're like, well, how am I going to do that?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So that looks good on paper. Might not be practical, though.
Now, you know your way around a set, Chuck, but you also know your way around the fairest city in the land, Boston. And you're from there originally. You're now back there. What's it been like for you as a native Bostonian to watch the sort of film and TV industry explode out there?
Well, I got to tell you, it has been incredible, but it has also been, you know, there are times when it's been a struggle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I know how important it is that we build this thing. I mean, and that's kind of the way I've always been with it, is that, you know, because my livelihood has depended on it, I've always, whenever there's been, you know, early on, whenever there's been some time that we've felt like, oh no, it's going to go away or something's going to happen, I've always tried to be, as one individual can be, as active as possible, mm-hmm. you know? So it's been a very, very important thing for me to just stay involved, you know? And I met a guy early on, this old guy who was involved in politics, and he told me, he was like, if you want them to listen, you got to build yourself a base, you know? And so I've always taken that into consideration. And the first time, you know, that our governor mentioned capping it, I remember I got all these people on Facebook. We were announcing that we're going to have this big event at the State House. We rallied, we went down there, finally, like the 11th hour, the unions got involved, and it was a huge turnout. And then the next, about 2 weeks later or something, I went to an event where the governor was there, and I was like, my buddy put me up on YouTube because I'm asking the governor, please don't cap the credit. Like, don't do it, you know? And so, you know, it's one of those things where I know how important it is, but it's always been that if people don't see the direct result, they don't think it's important. They don't see the benefit. And so, you know, the film tax credits are crucial. And that's why, you know, there's places like Atlanta right now that are, you know, filling up 154 productions last year because of the fact that they have such a good incentive. So, you know, but it takes the legislature, it takes people that don't normally sit in this business because they're the referees. So it takes them to say, hey, yeah, that's working. We should keep that going. But when you have chances where people can play politics and bring up, oh, it's not working, we can crush that, it doesn't matter, that's going to help our budget look good, well, then, yeah, I mean, you're not going to be able to see what's going on. So it's been important for me, you know, especially because coming back here when the tax credit first came out, I always felt like a baby of that tax credit. Like, right. I was in, when they were talking about the tax credit in its infancy, I felt like my career and being in the industry for me was in its infancy.
Yeah.
So it's always been a crucial thing for me to fight because, you know, I have to keep going because it's something that I want to do. It's my passion. It's my career, you know? And so I want to stay here. I love Austin, you know? And so it's like, I want to see this industry grow here, you know? I mean, but obviously again, politics will always prevail sometimes, but we have to play politics against politics. It's the only way to play.
Well, one of the things that Boston has going for it is, actually, a couple of things. One is that it's just a stunning, beautiful city. And even now, like in my mind's eye, I can remember sunsets in the Public Garden and things like that, and the Charles River and, you know, Harvard Square. So it's a beautiful, beautiful scenic city. But the other thing, too, that's got going for it is a lot of industry folks do spend time in Boston. As whether it be graduate programs, whether it be going to film schools like Emerson or the film program at BU and things like that. And I think a lot of, like, I mean, I know when I was there, I wrote, like, geez, I don't even know how many stories I wrote that were set in Boston and how many scripts where I'm like, oh, let's go back to Boston, you know? So I think that's something that the industry, I think, would love to have a base in Boston or a studio or two. But what is the state of the industry in Boston? How is the tax credit still going strong, or is it in danger, or is there things that, if people who are listening who kind of care about this issue in Massachusetts, is there any actions that they can take about this? Let's talk a bit about, like, what's the situation right now?
Yeah, well, what has happened is we had a budget. The governor first proposes his budget. He proposed rolling back the tax credit to raise the earned income tax credit. Anybody probably listening that's an industry person would know this because most governors around the country did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's believed it was a political move to pit legislatures against each other so they would allow, you know, certain Republican governors to look like heroes when it came to working families. The problem is, of course, is that it pits jobs against jobs, you know, and jobs against family. And it's the total wrong message. So the governor came out with his proposed bill, which would have done that. It went to the House. We have a very supportive House that really gets the film tax credit. They're getting it more and more. And those are the people that I think really over the years have had a good grasp on how it works and how it affects the economy. And so they said, no way, we're not touching it. We're not touching it. So then it went to our Senate. And in the Senate decided, a bunch of senators from the other side of the party, that's the thing. This is about policy. It's not about party. You know, tax credits, tax rebates, they're about policy. It's not about the party. So a bunch of senators from the other side of the aisle, they decided, oh, well, we're gonna do some bills that are going to kill tax credits, and we're going to bring this up because it's a good hot-button issue that's going to be able to be debated. Obviously, we haven't had a good interpretation from our Department of Revenue over the years. So you always hear, well, the Department of Revenue said tax credit doesn't work, you know. But that's an economic thing, because when you evaluate certain tax credits, they choose two ways to evaluate the tax credit, static and dynamic. Ours is a static study. We need a dynamic study of our credit, which shows the ramifications. Okay, that's what it is. But what has happened now is, so the Senate got it. They wanted to change the credit. They made a move which actually helped us, which was they pulled the earned income tax credit away from talking about touching the film tax credit. Then that went on to committee. And then the committee came out and said, we're not going to touch the film tax credit. It's over. It's a done deal. We'll keep it. Now the governor needs to sign the budget. If the governor signs the budget, we're solid, you know, aside from any legislative overrides. But, you know, it looks good. It looks good. But, you know, at the same time, I've always been somebody who I'm a practical guy, you know, and so will I take the win? Yes. But have we been fighting this battle for 4 years? Yes. So at a certain point, we have to figure out, like, us as an industry, are we doing the best to show them how it works? Are we really trying to go after, you know, hey, the Department of Revenue isn't evaluating the proper way and we need to change that? That might be where we're lacking. So, you know, it's something that we have to, as an industry, say, how do we prove our worth?
Yeah.
And how do we go forward? Because if we keep doing it this way every year, as you know, being involved in the industry wants stability. I mean, we want to know. That's why Georgia is so attractive right now. The producers have so much on the line that they want to know, if I go there, I'm going to be able to shoot, I'm going to be able to get my money, I'm going to be able to pay my people, and I'm going to be able to roll out and make more money on TV, Blockbuster, whatever I want to do. You know, that's where I need to know, and that's where I need to go with stability. And that's something that I think, you know, has to happen over time, but it's something that we have to force to happen. We can't wait for it.
Yeah, and New Orleans is like that too. And then, of course, there was a situation in Detroit where it literally dried up almost overnight, where they had the amazing tax credit and everybody was shooting everything in Detroit. And then almost like that, because when they pulled it, everybody pulled out. Because when we say tax credit, I mean, we're talking millions upon millions of dollars. Saved production-wise, and as you advocate, sometimes generated for jobs and things like that. I mean, these are big economic decisions. So, in one regard, I understand why there should be a certain amount of debate and discussion about it. But at the same time, does it help that with our industry, with the entertainment business? Like, I mean, I'm super proud of Boston's Finest. I'm proud as hell to have been involved in a show like that, and a show that was just that good, that came out that good. Like, does it help that when people are going, well, I don't know, what does this really do? That they can actually see a product like that, or see like a beautiful movie, and be like, oh wow, no, this really is something important. We're really contributing something vital, and we're promoting our city.
Well, and that's it. That's why, you know, in my mind, and I know that originally when they passed this tax incentive, the way that it was supposed to work was Department of Revenue was supposed to report numbers, and creative economy, economic development was supposed to come and evaluate the numbers, and that sort of got muddied in the waters. And that's why it's very important, because, you know, travel and tourism, you know, these are things that sometimes, you know, there's other tax credits out there for some of the craziest things. And how do you measure their worth? Yeah. Their worth is measured by the legislature saying that's something we hold as important. You know, I mean, there's tax credits for marriage, there's tax credits for corn, there's tax credits for all these other companies and all these other businesses, because they are deemed valuable. And at some point, people have to realize that movie and entertainment, I mean, that's a valuable product. That's a valuable product because of even situations like Boston's Finest, where it's like we're showing the city in the best possible light possible.
Yeah,
and so
the people in it.
And the people in it. And that's right. And that's why, you know, it's important that in those situations, it's like, this is a good product. This is something that is going to make us proud, people know, you know, to come to Boston. Boston's a great city, and there's history here. I mean, we have a big tax credit for history. You know, we have this whole thing about, you know, historic places and preserving historic places. So, you know, the thing is that we have to hold movies in the same esteem, you know, and we have to realize that, like, you know, movies are, they're something that everybody sees and everybody knows how important it is, and they start affecting tourism. They start affecting travel.
Yeah.
People are like, I want to go there. You know, it's the same as when they talk about when the Red Sox win the World Series or the Patriots win the Super Bowl. Everybody in the city makes more money because everybody's amped up and excited, you know?
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
the same kind of thing.
It's the Patriots won their fourth Super Bowl this year.
I knew I would get you with that. I think it's their fourth Super Bowl
in the past 13 years. I don't know how many other NFL teams have won four Super Bowls in the past 13, 14 years. I think that answer is zero. But it's funny. The point is, it's interesting. When I first took Megan to Boston, we started in the North End, and we did the Old North Church and Freedom Trail, and you know, I mean, taking a picture of the Old North Church, which is like, my God, I mean, this is it. Every kid in America knows one if by land, two if by sea, and this is the Revolutionary War and the harbor with the Tea Party, Boston Tea Party, you know, and then we walk through the public garden, and we find the tree from Goodwill Hunting, which was a tree that I actually sat and read, I can't even tell you, 70, 80 books during my 4 years at Emerson. I sat at that tree so often, and I was actually mad at the movie because I was like, I should be sitting there, but that's okay, I got over it. And then we went up the street to 500 Boylston, which is the Boston Legal Building. And of course, and Cheers, for crying out loud, how much revenue has Cheers generated for businesses in the city? I mean, how many, I remember living there, like, and people with that, people who couldn't speak a lick of English be like, excuse, viz, Cheers. And it's like, yes, right up the street, you'd have to point them because they just wanted to see Cheers. It was crazy. It's wild. Boston has the best of both worlds there. So I really hope you're right. I hope that they keep figuring that out, you know?
Yeah. And that's what will happen over time. But obviously anytime they're ready to cut it down, then it's not going to grow. So, you know, we have to make sure that we're being smart about it, and that we are showing people our value constantly, because that's what we have to do as an industry, is say, look, we're valuable. I mean, we do it as individuals, and we need to do it as an industry as a whole, is saying this is valuable and it's important. It's important for everything. I mean, you know, it's just like the kid at Emerson writing the scripts for the future, you know, that's important stuff, you know?
Well, I was that kid, and
I know.
And you're a real champion, and it sounds like, I mean, you know, does it sound like, I mean, you, how much, does the industry out there, are they behind you? You know, are you helping, like, it just, I don't know, I'm just, like, really impressed with your championing, and, like, I mean, confronting the governor himself, and just not being shy about this, you know? If nobody, who else is going to do it, if not you, right?
Well, you know, and that's the thing. We have a really good community here. We have a lot of really good groups, and you know, and so it's one of those things where I know how important it is for me, and I also know how important it is for everybody else. So I know that there are people out there doing great things, and they're out there and they're pushing for it.
Yeah.
And it's like one of those things where I go to events, film events and other events, and people say thank you. I just think that's enough, you know. It's like, that's amazing that, you know, I've caused enough effect in somebody to just say thank you to me, you know, and I love that personally. But again, it's not thanking me, it's thanking us, because, you know, yeah, it's going to take a few people that aren't going to want to be quiet, and they're not going to be shy, and they're going to be able to get in situations where, you know, here I am sitting next to the governor, well, I'm going to talk to him.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be afraid to say, you know, but it's also about, like, knowing what to say, you know, because you can also look silly if you're like, yeah, film rocks, man.
Right. Well, you also have a point. I mean, you have a practical, pragmatic point. I mean, you've quoted a lot of statistics. You've done your research on this. So when you turn around and say, look, Governor, I only got you for 30 seconds, you're going to put some a real detailed intelligence behind what you're saying, which is always important, as opposed to, like, just screaming at him or saying, hey, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's a core skill that, you know, I've honed over networking, because the more people you talk to, the better you get at talking to people. And so it's something that, you know, hey, put him in the room, I'll talk to him, you know.
Absolutely.
And so It's just something that you have to do, and you gotta, again, it goes back to the boiler points. You gotta like people. I mean, you can't not like people.
Yep.
This is a people person industry.
So, all right, well, listen, we're hoping and wishing for the best for Boston. I am, my fingers are crossed. If you're listening to this, you've never been to Boston, I highly recommend it for a weekend in the fall, autumn, spring. Go see a Red Sox game. Just go and explore the town and the city. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. And but Chuck, what's the future like for you? That's my last question for you. What are your immediate goals or long-term goals in the business? What do you want 2015, 2016 to look like for you in the business in Boston?
Well, first and foremost, I will say that probably by the time this interview comes out and I'm speaking solely as an individual, I'll be running for the SAG-AFTRA presidency. So my hope is that I would get elected to be the president of our New England local.
Oh, but that's
again,
awesome. Well,
that's
fingers crossed.
That's as an individual. I'm stating that as an individual. I want to be very clear.
Yeah,
no. So, but other than that, you know, the big hope is to keep working. To keep waking every day and finding a job in the business and stay in the business as long as possible, you know, because the fact of the matter is I have two children who I've always wanted to say to them, look, I never gave up on the dream, you
yeah.
know, no matter how hard it got. And I know that someday they're going to remember that I pushed through. And so that's why I do this. That's one of the main reasons. And it's also because, again, I love people. I love the industry. You know, moving, making has been something that I've wanted since I was a kid. And so I just keep pushing forward and not looking back. So I'm hoping that, you know, I stay in the business as long as possible and people know my name and, you know, hey, it's good to feel loved. So, you know, whatever we could do to keep pushing forward, that's what I say.
Well, you know, you stay in the business, Chuck, because we need people like you. This has been a fantastic. And the other thing, too, I have to throw out an enormous amount of credit to Chuck. Dear listener, you guys aren't going to know this, but we've had more technical difficulties doing this interview and scheduling mix-ups than every other episode combined. And like a true production pro, Chuck did not complain once. He rolled with the punches. He said, no problem with it. Oh, my gosh. I can't thank you enough for being so patient and such a pro with what has been a very strange set of technical difficulties recording this episode.
Well, it's because you're so handsome. How am I supposed to say no?
No, but this has been great fun. Really, really great. Really fascinating, too, to hear about some of the things. Because here in L.A. and in New York, you don't go through. We don't have to fight the way you guys do in Boston. So it's really fascinating to hear that. And the fingers are crossed to keep it going. Because the industry is big enough to spread to several cities. I firmly believe that. Especially as we get into more streaming and webisodes and series and things like that. So, fingers are crossed and best wishes to Boston to stay in the business. Best wishes to you, Chuck. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Tim. I really enjoyed it. And anytime you want to talk, call me anytime. I'm always available. So.
Oh, you're the man, dude. Anyway, and thank you, everybody, for listening, retweeting, downloading. Keep spreading the word. And we will see you soon on the Handsome Timmy D Express.